From KRCB in Santa Rosa, it's Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour with Michelle Anna Jordan.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the completely redesigned 300-horsepower MDX. More information is available at Acura.com.
You better come on in my kitchen. There's hard to be ready.
Tonight on Mouthful, Terry Pischoff-Werthner discusses in a Cajun kitchen, and Mouthful Salon continues with Deborah Walton of Canvas Ranch. So stay tuned for the wine country's most delicious hour.
Tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry to make sure it doesn't stick. You got to do a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? Add a little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet. My country, tis of thee. I eat for social progress. I eat for victory.
Delicious.
Stay hungry, stay hungry, stay hungry.
You want some more?
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour. I'm Michelle Jordan. How are you doing this evening? Thanks for tuning in. In a Cajun Kitchen, Authentic Recipes and Stories from a Family Farm on the Bayou was released last fall by St. Martin's Press. It's a really interesting book. It walks you through all you need to know to coax out traditional Cajun flavors from everyday ingredients. There are such dishes as beef roast with gravy, pepper roasted chicken with lemon pan drippings. That just sounds so good to me. Pork chop etouffee, crawfish pie, green beans with salt pork, smothered cabbage with andouille, and of course, for dessert, bread pudding. Terry Werthner, the author, Terry Pischoff-Werthner, I should say, is a 10th generation Acadian. She has deep roots in the bayou, but she also has a really strong presence here in the wine country of Northern California. Terry, welcome to Mouthful.
Thanks for having me, Michelle.
You bet. I'm glad you were available. And also joining us on a return visit to Mouthful is Deborah Walton of Canvas Ranch. When we get towards the end of the hour, we're going to continue our Mouthful Salon with Deborah. But in the meantime, Deborah, thank you for coming.
Oh, my pleasure.
And if you just want to jump in as I'm talking to Terry about this yummy book, you feel free.
I have lots of questions because I can't cook.
I don't believe you, but we'll find out. Terry, tell me about what does it mean to be a 10th generation Acadian? And have you known that all your life, or was that something you discovered?
That's something I discovered in the early 90s when I went to Louisiana for the first time and really got in touch with my Cajun roots. And it was a huge turning point in my life. But to address your first question, in the 1600s, many people from France, agrarian people, craftsmen and farmers, went to Acadia, which is now known as Nova Scotia. They settled there and led a very, very happy, harmonious life near the Mi'kmaq Indians. A lot of the Frenchmen who came over married Mi'kmaq Indians. My ancestor, my 10th great-grandfather, Louis Noel LeBove, was one of the first settlers in Acadia. He arrived there in 1678, and he's on my father's mother's side. My father's father's side is also Acadian and goes back to the 1600s. In 1755, the English kicked the Acadians out of Acadia, supposedly because the Acadians would not pledge allegiance to the English throne, but also in part because the English wanted their lands. And they brutally and cruelly separated families, separated parents and children and husbands and wives, grandparents and grandchildren, put members of families on different boats, different ships, and they were sent to different parts of the world. Many of them ended up in southwest Louisiana. So it took some 2 or 3 or 4 years to get there. My relatives were among those who ended up in southwest Louisiana. They settled there in about 1775. They arrived, and they were sort of wandering for about 20 years and ended up in the area near St. Martinville, Franklin, Louisiana, which was originally the capital of Louisiana. And they have lived there ever since. And the farm on the top of the book strip is the farm that my great-great-grandfather built in 1850 when he and my great-grandmother got married. And that's where they raised their seven children. And my father and my aunts and my great-aunts and uncles all lived on that farm, and their lives were centered around that farm.
Now, when you were growing up, were you aware of the farm? Was the farm still in the family?
The farm was still in the family. I was born and raised in San Francisco and was raised as a Cajun, although I had no idea that I was being raised differently mm-hmm. from anyone else until our friends in San Francisco would come to dinner and kind of look at the food and see crawfish and think pudding out of bread. And they thought our food was a little bit weird until they tasted it. But my grandparents would come visit us from Louisiana, and my aunt and my father and my great aunts and uncles all taught us how to cook Cajun food. My mother is Irish, and she had a lot of interests other than cooking. She wasn't particularly interested in cooking. And my dad did most of the cooking, and I just grew up learning how to make roux, and we had four kinds of pepper on the table. And to me, it was just normal. And Friday night was story night. My father would tell us every Friday night. It was almost, it was casual, but it was a formality that every Friday night he would spend several hours with all four of his children telling us about our Cajun ancestors.
What a great thing for a father to do. That's really wonderful.
It was wonderful.
Now, you set out on a culinary career before you ever went to Louisiana, right?
This is true.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I had a catering business in the early 80s and then wrote a cookbook. I kind of came in the back door rather than working up to it. I met somebody who had an idea for a cookbook and asked if I would do the recipes because she was a writer, not a cook.
What was the book?
The book was called Food for Life, the Cancer Prevention Cookbook. Mm-hmm. It was published in 86, really before its time. The National Cancer Institute had just come out with the guidelines that if you follow certain eating patterns that you can reduce your risk of getting cancer. All very conservative, nothing dramatic, but cruciferous vegetables, low fat, high fiber, vitamin A, vitamin C, antioxidants, and so forth. So I developed 250 recipes to go with that book, and it was reissued in 1998 with new recipes. But after the book was published in 86, I was interviewed by a magazine about the book, and I asked the editor of that magazine, Medical Self-Care, published in Sebastopol at the time, if I could write a food article, and I ended up becoming food editor for that magazine and then writing for many national newspapers and magazines.
Mm-hmm. And at what point did you start to incorporate, was it after your visit to Louisiana that you began to incorporate your Cajun heritage into your cooking?
Yes, to me, Cajun food was just normal everyday food. That's the way we ate. And in 1992, my two sisters, they're half a generation older than I am, and I had grade school, or well, actually three teenage daughters at that time, and their kids were gone, and they planned a trip to Louisiana and wanted me to go with them. And I said, I can't leave these three teenage kids. My husband works full time. And they said, well, why would you want to stay home if you've got three teenage kids? So that they talked me into it. And I was just going along for the fun of it. One of my sisters had been working extensively on the genealogy of our family. And when we actually started to drive into the town where my father was born and raised, where this family farm was.
And what's the name of the town?
It's an area called Ashton. It's 8 miles east of Franklin, Louisiana. And that is the closest large town most people know of is New Iberia or St. Martinville. And to me, it was just a fun trip until we actually started to drive down the driveway to the farm, and I realized that this farm had been in our family for almost 150 years, that my great-great-grandparents were married and started their lives there. That's where the bayou was, where my dad and aunt would have to go get crawfish when great-grandpa wanted a gumbo. The whole history I'd been hearing about all my life for decades was right there in front of me, and I was just awestruck that this was a real place. Mm-hmm. And the buildings are very dilapidated now, but at that time, the buildings, it was right before Hurricane Andrew in 92.
Now, was anyone living there at that point?
No one was living there at that point. And it had just recently passed out of the hands of our family, and a neighbor purchased it. All Cajuns are neighbors, and they're all relatives, too. And he was very kind about letting us, my sisters and I, wander through the farmhouse and all the outbuildings. And we were able to walk into the kitchen at that time and see this kitchen where generations of my family had cooked meals and eaten at the long table that took up the whole room, and see where all the cast iron pots had hung. And I saw something sparkle, and I looked under a cabinet, and there was this glass jar that was kind of tucked away, and I lifted it out, and it was an old olive oil jar that was beautifully embossed with leaves, and it said bone oil, and there was still some olive oil in the bottom of it. And none of my relatives had cooked in that kitchen for about 40 years at that point, and that jar had just stayed there in the same spot where one of them had apparently dropped it. And I picked that up and just felt so connected to whatever relative, my great aunt, my grandmother, my great grandmother, who had last touched it when they were going to make a gumbo or an etouffee. Mm-hmm. And I was the next person to lift that up and touch it, and I felt just so connected to all of them, and just so in touch with my Cajun roots. And it was very dramatic to me for all of this to be opened up and to realize that I was such a part of something that had just been stories to me.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, to have those stories made flesh, mm-hmm. so to speak, must have been really powerful.
It was very powerful.
Where's that bottle now?
It's in my living room.
It
on
is
a bookshelf.
Great. You are listening to Mouthful here on KRCB.
This friend of mine from Paris had been born and raised in Paris and never been out of the city in his life, and came to Louisiana to visit. So one day my father told him, he said, I'm going to take you down to Melville, he said, and cook you a fish out in the woods. So we came down the river, we bought a catfish. We were three people. We bought a catfish, I think it weighed 12 pounds, and we went out in the woods somewhere back yonder, and we cooked that fish, and we ate it all 12 pounds, three people. And this young man said, he said, you know what? He said, I've been in all those fancy restaurants, he said, in Paris. He said, the most famous restaurants that had international fame for their cuisine. But he said, I have never in my born days had eaten something that had so much aroma and taste as this food here in that old black pot. It was all cooked into one pot, you know. It took maybe a half an hour to cook. It wasn't all done in separate dishes, and it took all day to cook. In half an hour, it was done in one pot, you know. That's what really amazed him. He said, I've never eaten anything that tastes like this.
Listening to Searching for Acadia by Beausoleil, and that quote before the music is from really a wonderful movie, Les Blancs, popular here on Mouthful. He's been a guest two or three times. The movie is Yum Yum Yum, and it shows cooking in the bayou and in New Orleans. It's just a wonderful recipe. One of the things in the film, they show a lot of what, like, shacks, bayou shacks, out in the middle of nowhere, and people would just go there for the sole purpose of cooking and have a bit. Did you come across any of those sorts of things while you were down there, the shacks?
Yes. Most Cajun families have a second home, which they call their camp.
Yeah.
And it might be a shack. It might be just a small home. It might be a prefab home on a small lot. But it's where they go to hunt and fish and cook. They hunt and fish and then spend the weekend cooking the food that they have hunted for and fished for. And that's where they go to have parties. Most Cajuns spend almost every weekend at their camp. They don't travel a lot. They don't really see any reason to because they have everything they want there. Cajuns often live in the same house, many generations live in the same house, and they live nearby in the same towns. Families, cousins, brothers, sisters, parents, grandparents are often all within minutes of each other.
Mm-hmm. That brings me to something I wanted to be sure to talk about, and I have to promise you we will get to specifics of recipes. We will talk about what is Cajun food, what's the difference with Creole food. But before we get too far away from some of the things you said at the beginning, when you talked about how England threw the Acadians out and really cruelly separated families, that brings us up to contemporary times and Hurricane Katrina, when exactly the same thing happened. You know, babies sent one place, the mother, the father sent other places. And here you're talking about how the extended family is so important to the region. So I know that I think it's the introduction of the book, you talk about how some of the funds from this book go to Katrina relief. Do you want to talk a little bit about that and that, you know, your involvement with that whole thing?
Yes, part of the proceeds of the book will be donated to the Louisiana Library Association, which has an ongoing effort to try and restore some of the historical and culinary documents that were damaged by the hurricane. And this is apart from my personal funds that went, you know, that I may have donated for mm-hmm. relief to the people. But, of course, the amount from a book is not going to build a highway or erect houses. But it can go a little farther, relatively speaking, to help restore some of these documents that may be lost forever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of family documents also in the public record.
Yes, both. There are 24 boxes of our family papers archived at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. And fortunately, those were all saved. But a lot of families have papers that have been archived at different universities and libraries that have been damaged. And if they're not attended to relatively soon, if they're let go for years, they're lost forever.
Yeah, they rot away.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a really great thing to do, and a nice thing to be able to do with a book. Now, there's a documentary made about your family, right? Louisiana Public Broadcasting?
Yes, which is like our KQED.
KRCB, for that matter.
Yes, of course. Pardon me. When I was in Louisiana on book tour in October and November, Louisiana Public Broadcasting filmed for 3 days. And they filmed me at the Louisiana Book Festival, where I was one of the authors. And they filmed me they interviewed me, first of all, for mm-hmm. quite a while, about the book, about the family, about the history. And then they interviewed a family reunion of the LeBov. I don't think I said that LeBov is the family name, mm-hmm. our Cajun family name. And I had met several dozen cousins over the internet, had never met them in person. But they had helped me with some family history and some facts. Many of them still lived in the area of Louisiana where my dad was born or nearby. And we got to know each other over the internet and ended up having a reunion of about 70 people when I was down there on book tour. So this is also part of what Louisiana Public Broadcasting filmed.
Mm-hmm. Now, has that been shown yet? Is it finished yet?
It was shown there. I have a CD of it. But it was shown there on a segment called The State We're In.
Mm-hmm. Sounds really interesting. I mean, how great to, like, all these relatives and you find them on the internet. I love that.
It was wonderful. I've met one cousin who still lived on the same street that her great-great-grandmother used to go horseback riding on. I mean, the history is just mm-hmm. so strong there.
And it's something that it's really hard to find that in California.
It is.
California is so new. I mean, every now and then you come across someone who's been here for seven generations or something, but it's usually not on the same property, and it's certainly not on the same street.
It's true.
So it's like hearing about a parallel universe for someone who's from the West. Back to Cajun cooking. First, let's define Cajun cooking and talk a little bit about what distinguishes it from Creole cooking, because I think a lot of people don't really know.
Well, a lot of people are confused by the two, because when someone goes to New Orleans, there's both Cajun and Creole cooking, Cajun and Creole restaurants, and many of the restaurants have both types of food. But essentially, Creole food is city cooking. It uses a lot of fish, fin fish rather than as much shellfish, butter, cream. It's fancier cooking. Cajun cooking could be defined as one-pot cooking. Everything's cooked in one pot for a long time, and the base of most savory Cajun dishes is roux, which is oil and flour mm-hmm. that's cooked together anywhere from 10 to 60 minutes, depending on the depth of toastiness you want.
Mm-hmm. And learning to make a roux, that's a skill in itself, isn't it?
Well, it is. In the book, I say that I could describe roux in two sentences, or I could write a whole paragraph about it. Basically, the trick is to use equal parts oil and flour and cook it over low heat, preferably in a cast iron pan, because that helps it get dark mm-hmm. faster. And you cannot rush it. You have to cook it over low to medium low heat. You don't even want it simmering. And you'll be rewarded with this wonderful base to which you then add the Holy Trinity, which is onion, celery, and bell pepper, and your liquid, and your chicken or meat, and then cook it for anywhere from at least 45 minutes to 2 or 3 hours.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, the difference between a gumbo, for example, made by someone who doesn't know how to make roux versus a gumbo made by someone who knows how to make roux, it's night and day. And one bite, you know if you're eating a real gumbo or not.
Absolutely. You can taste the roux in a gumbo or a fricassee or any dish immediately. You can mm-hmm. taste not the roux, but you can taste the fact that it was
that
based
depth.
On a roux.
It's this depth, and it's also, and this is somebody, you know, with no Cajun roots whatsoever speaking. But I'll tell you, when I went to New Orleans for the first time, it was in 1986, and I went with a friend who had lived there briefly, and we decided to go for Jazz Festival, Jazz and Heritage Festival. And I had, at that point, I had never eaten a raw oyster, had never eaten red beans and rice, and I got to the Jazz Festival. It was the food festival. I listened to some music, but I just went from food booth to food booth. I ate alligator. I ate my first bread pudding. We were on a riverboat the night before with music on three floors, but on the fourth floor was the food. That's where I had red beans and rice for the first time, had my first raw oyster, and then went up and got two dozen more oysters, ate oysters every day that I was there. It is just, New Orleans was an exquisite place to eat. And those Cajun flavors, once you know them, you know, you can sort of find them in restaurants and maybe in your own kitchen. And it's one of the things I love about the book is the way you really guide people to that. I completely interrupted whatever it was you were going to say.
I was through with what I was saying. But that's true in Cajun country, too. For people who don't know, Cajun country is southwest of New Orleans by about 2 hours. And there's a triangle with plantation country, Cajun country, and New Orleans. So you get a lot of bang for your buck if you take a trip down to that area, because you can be in three completely different worlds, even on the same day, a long day. But mm-hmm. but in Cajun country, they have little cafes adjacent to gas stations or gas stations that open up a little area and serve food. even in places like that, that casual, the food is very good.
Yeah, I think the casual food is, in my experience, the casual food has been the best food in that area.
Yeah, well, Cajun food is casual. Yeah. Fancy Cajun food is not traditional Cajun food.
Yeah, and red beans and rice, Cajun, right?
Yes.
Not Creole, Cajun.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the best things in the world, well-done red beans and rice.
And it was started, many of the dishes, because the housewife had to put something on to cook that she could cook over low heat for a long time while she went outside and tended the garden and took care of the children and made the soap and so forth. So it's not fancy cooking, but it's good cooking. These people are French, and they know how to cook.
Yeah, they like to eat.
Yes,
that's
absolutely
one of the things about them.
We've always looked at cooking as part of our entertainment. We've always looked at eating as part of our celebration. There was always one great cook in a neighborhood, and I'm talking about maybe five or six families was a neighborhood, because you lived a mile or two apart. And there was somebody who would cook, and the somebody in our neighborhood was my mother, and there was always somebody who could play the fiddle or somebody who could play the accordion, and we'd all get together at the house and cook and move furniture and dance and raise hell and have a good time. You are listening to Mouthful on KRCB Public Radio for Sonoma County. I'm Michelle Jordan. Thanks for sticking with us this evening, or this afternoon if you happen to be listening through podcast. My guest, Terry Pischoff-Werthner, author of In a Cajun Kitchen, Authentic Cajun Recipes and Stories from a Family Farm on the Bayou. Also in the studio with us, but currently being very quiet, Deborah Walton of Canvas Ranch. We'll be talking with Deborah in just a little bit. Cajun food is not, by definition or by nature, real hot. It's not like, say, really spicy Mexican food, that sort of thing. Am I right?
That's very true. Cajun food is not spicy. They do use four types of pepper, white, black, red, and then a pepper sauce, like McElhaney is probably the best known mm-hmm. brand, when you want pepper with a little vinegar mm-hmm. flavor. But it's not spicy. I think out of 180 recipes in the book, there are probably five that could be considered spicy.
Mm-hmm. Is sauce piquante one of them?
Yes.
Would you talk about that one? Because that's one of the ones that the guy from Yum Yum Yum, that's one of the quotes where he mentions sauce piquante. And that's just one of the classic things you always hear mentioned with Cajun food.
Well, sauce piquante is, it could be chicken, could be made with fish. It's one of the favorite Cajun dishes of Cajun people, sauce piquante and coubillon, which is a fish cross between a soup and a stew. Sauce piquante does have some heat to it. It's the only hot recipe that my grandmother liked to make. Some of my other relatives made things that were a little bit spicier. But it has three different types of pepper in it. And I have two recipes. One is a chicken sauce piquante, and one is just a sauce piquante, which is a sauce that you can then put over anything, roast or potatoes, mm-hmm. rice. Cajuns eat rice probably at least once a day.
Mm-hmm. And what sort of the defining elements of sauce piquante? What is it? Tomatoes? Is it a tomato-based sauce?
Yes, there are always tomatoes in sauce piquante, and garlic, the usual bay leaves. This has salt, white pepper, and black pepper. It's thickened with a mixture of cornstarch and water at the end. And my Aunt Lorna's sauce piquante is then, she serves it with poultry, seafood, meat, game vegetables. She liked to keep it in the refrigerator to have whenever she had leftovers, or sometimes she'd roast something and put the sauce piquante on it. She probably had it at least once a week. Mm-hmm. If she wasn't making chicken or fish sauce piquante, then she would have the sauce that she could use on anything else.
Uh-huh. How did you get these recipes? Were these recipes in part that you knew from your childhood and your dad's cooking? How did you put them together? And I also want to talk about where you put some of them together, because I think that's really interesting, Dairy Hollow.
Oh, yes. Well, a lot of the recipes were passed down to me by my aunt, my father's sister. She and I, from the time I was in grade school, would just sit and visit, and she would pull out one of her recipe boxes, and she would say, oh, this was my grandmother's recipe, her grandmother, my great-grandmother's recipe. And she would talk about how that would be made on Sundays, or how Aunt Irma liked to make bread pudding, but she always put too much vanilla in it, according to Great Aunt Alice. And I got the stories behind these recipes. There were dozens of those. Some I didn't use because they just wouldn't translate to today's cooking. A pot spoon full of flour, I came to realize, was 1.5 tablespoons, because mm-hmm. I wanted to give exact measurements. I wanted all the recipes to
sort of cookbook editors these days make you do that anyway, well, whether you want to or not.
But then some of the recipes I developed because I had been making them all my life, mm-hmm. and I just started writing them down. I realized, well, gosh, I want the recipe for crawfish etouffee, and I just knew how to make it, but I'd get ready to shake some salt into the etouffee, or put some cayenne or some thyme, and I'd intercept it as it was going into the pot with my hand, and then mm-hmm. I would measure it. Mm-hmm. And once I did that and got exact measurements, then, you know, I tested again once or twice to make sure that it worked. But a lot of them were very simple to write down, because I knew that I always used, you know, 3 cucumbers and a cup of mayonnaise and mm-hmm. 1 red onion in my dad's cucumber salad and so forth. And then there were some recipes that my newfound internet cousins gave me. So it was a combination. They're all family recipes. Most of them were handed down to me in one form or another.
Mm-hmm. And then you spent some of your time putting together the book, and I guess testing some of the recipes, at the Writer's Colony at Dairy Hollow in Eureka Springs. How long were you there?
I was actually there 3 times. Eureka Springs is the first writer's colony in the world, to my knowledge and to their knowledge, that has a kitchen adjacent to one of the writers' studios or one of the writers' rooms, so that food writers can actually test their recipes while they're working on a book or a manuscript. Because food writers, when they're writing a cookbook or an article, you're going from your computer into the kitchen to test the recipe or to weigh something, and it's very helpful to have a kitchen there.
Yeah.
And that kitchen was beautiful. It was designed and built by Renovation Style magazine, and they interviewed many chefs and got everyone's opinion on the most ideal kitchen, and it was a beautiful $125,000 brand new kitchen. When I walked in there, I was the first person to receive a culinary fellowship there, mm-hmm. and the first person to use a kitchen, and it was a wonderful experience.
How long were your stays?
The first time I was there for a month, and I received a second fellowship. I was there for 3 weeks, and another time I was there for 2 weeks. So,
now, when you were testing recipes, what did you do with them afterwards? Were you feeding other people in the colony?
Oh, absolutely. The other mm-hmm. writers were very, very happy. Uh-huh. And the cook was very happy that she got several nights off.
Ah, okay. Okay, yeah. Writer's colonies are great. I've been to Yaddo. They don't have a kitchen, but that's okay. I was working on other things. But yeah, I know about Dairy Hollow. It's really great that there's that resource. And Eureka Springs, of course, that's a pretty popular place with poets, writers, artists, that sort of thing, isn't it?
It is. It's a historical town. It's very beautiful. It's surrounded by lakes and mountains. Mm-hmm. and it still has a little streetcar that takes you up the hill to the hotel. And it's somewhat touristy, but not overly so. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful place, very Victorian.
Mm-hmm. And when were you there? Was it while you were actually working on this manuscript?
All three times I was there, I was working on this book.
Mm-hmm. How long did it take you to
I started writing the book the day after I came home from my trip in 1992. I co-authored two other books during the 14 years between mm-hmm. starting it and having it published, because I did so much research on the history of the Acadian people, the history of my Acadian relatives, and the history of Cajun people. And I went down to Louisiana three times to study the history of our family that was archived at the university. Mm-hmm. And then putting all the recipes in form and testing them. And then I was writing newspaper and magazine articles,
sure.
too. So this was sometimes put on the shelf for months at a time.
Mm-hmm. It's been really well received. It was, was 19 best cookbooks of last year on New York Times list, is that right?
Yes, at the end of each year they come out with their 19 cookbooks of the year. Corby Cummer makes that list for us, for them. And I was very pleased that the book was on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really great. If you can get in the New York Times, you get a lot of attention. How's it? Is it selling well?
Yes, it is. Slowly but consistently.
Uh-huh. Congratulations. And you have some events. You have a lot of events coming up. You do a lot of teaching all over the country, right?
Yes.
You want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, I'm teaching a couple of classes in Santa Rosa soon. I just taught one at the Ritz-Carlton in Half Moon Bay, which is a gorgeous spot. But I have a website that is probably easier to tell you about than to list the events, because mm-hmm. there are so many coming up. My website is terris-kitchen.com,
so,
and I'll spell that out.
T-E-R-R-I-S dash kitchen, KITCHEN.com.
Yes.
So the tricky thing there, no apostrophe, and get the dash in.
Right.
That's the little short line. So terriskitchen.com. So you have a list of all your appearances, your book signings, your classes.
Yes, it's all there.
Okay, tell us what else you find on the website.
There are some recipes on the website. There's a history of the Acadian people and the history of the book, and my calendar, and samples of my writing, some of the articles, or excerpts from the articles mm-hmm. I've done for the Washington Post and Bon Appetit and so mm-hmm. forth.
Well, it's a really wonderful book. Congratulations, Terry, and thank you for taking the time. I know you're busy.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And you're welcome to stay around when we're going to pull Deborah in our next segment and do our little salon thing, but you're welcome to stick around and participate.
I'd eat my grandma's cooking. I'd eat the gumbos and the sauce piquant she'd make and the pies, and I'd look at that, and I loved that stuff. I'd look at my father the way he'd make a gumbo or a sauce piquant, and it was almost just like his mother was, because he loved it also, and I loved it. But it looks like when somebody doesn't really give a damn about something, well, listen, I think I'm going to add a little bit of this, maybe. It was never been done before. Or I'm going to add a little bit of this, or I'm going to put this note here instead. And I'm not against anything changing, you know, because I think the natural process, the natural way just of living and dying changes things enough. But when you really love something, whether it's cooking a bowl of gumbo or a pot full of sauce piquant or playing a pretty two-step or waltz, if you really love it, you're going to try to do it just like the person you heard it or tasted it. You'll do it just like it. To me, when you really love something for what it is, you leave it alone.
Say men are leading, the women are slaving.
Yeah, we're smarter and we can cook, too. We prove it here all the time on Mouthful. That final quote just before the song, that was C.J. Chenier, by the way, was from Les Blank, the film Yum Yum Yum. I believe nearly all of Les Blank's short films are available in your local video store and also on Netflix. If they're not available in your local video store, and I know for certain that Videodroid in Santa Rosa has Les Blank films, do go to Netflix because he's pretty well represented there. You can also go to blankfilms.com, and nearly everything is for sale. And things like Yum Yum Yum, Werner Herzog Eats His Shoe, In Heaven There Is No Beer, those are movies that you definitely want to see more than once. So, Deborah, you going to talk now?
Hey, Michelle. Sure, I can talk.
Last week, I had John Ash on, in part because a conversation John and I had a few months ago sort of inspired this new feature I want to add to Mouthful. It was John's idea that we call it Mouthful Salon. And it's an ongoing conversation, and I'm inviting listeners to also get involved, not by doing, not by calling, but by thinking about this topic and sending emails, catsmilk@sonic.net. As it sounds, catsmilk@sonic.net is where you can send me your thoughts or questions or even sort of subtopics that you might want us to pursue. But the general idea is, who is food for? John mentioned last week, both good news and bad news, that Walmart has announced a while ago that they will be following as much as they possibly can the guidelines on seafood set out by the Monterey Bay Aquarium. I think that's really good news. You know, if we fish the ocean, if we take all the fish, there won't be fish for anybody. But one of the things that John found really sort of surprising was that a lot of the chefs who were members of Chefs Collaborative were upset that Walmart was getting involved. They wanted to keep this whole idea of, you know, really following guidelines and being very thoughtful about sustainable farming. If they got upset that Walmart was going to do it, then they were thinking about it from an elitist point of view.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that I think has really changed the way we farm and the way we think about food is what we are calling the Walmartizing of our food source, and the fact that organic now has become just, it's ubiquitous in terms mm-hmm. of what it used to mean, which was the farmer touching the food. And I think that's what it really comes down to. We've got a huge disconnect between how we grow our food or how we fish our food and all of that. There's a big disconnect between that and what you're finding on the shelves of your local grocery store or Walmart. So, excuse me, I've got a little cold. With Terry's book, for instance, it's just fascinating that the whole tradition of Cajun cooking has to do with what they found outside their front door, or outside their camp door. And what we've done now is taken and industrialized our food sources so much that they were completely removed from it. And now consumers are getting removed from it. I go into the grocery store now and I don't even recognize food. It truly is just all packaged and processed and put together for us so that you don't know what's in there, and that's scary.
Mm-hmm. But yet at the same time, there's a movement, and your ranch is a really classic expression of one of the things that's happening. You operate a CSA, mm-hmm. Community Supported Agriculture, which is a subscription to a farm that provides you with weekly, biweekly, monthly, you know, a bag of produce from the farm. So it's, in a way, it's sort of returning to what people always did, but in a modern structure.
It's trying to get people reconnected, mm-hmm. and I think that's really what my passion is in that way. We just had one of the CSA members was out visiting today, and I wasn't there while she was there, but she brought her daughter and her grandson just so that they could experience the farm and to see vegetables still growing out there, even though mm-hmm. it's been freezing cold. And I think a lot of people think they just can't possibly, but what it does is make Brussels sprouts the most delicious things you've ever had. But anyway, the idea of being reconnected with the person who grows your food, who then goes out, I'm the one who grows it and picks it and packs it and delivers it to somebody that I've had a direct connection with, is actually going back to the old ways of doing things, where it was neighbors or families all cooking together mm-hmm. and experiencing food together. Mm-hmm. And we think of our CSA customers as part of our family. They're invited out to the farm anytime they want to be out. And they can even help harvest if they want mm-hmm. and pull weeds.
Now, what I'm wondering is, with the CSA, who subscribes to CSAs? Is it something these days that struggling families can't afford to do? Is it something that is more for people who are comfortable, bought property at the right time? You know what I mean.
Yeah,
is there that elitist split?
We're on the border between Marin and Sonoma County, mm-hmm. and in order for us to make it so that we can do this kind of thing, mm-hmm. we're not getting rich being farmers, but mm-hmm. in order for us to be able to do it, we do have to charge something for the
food.
Of course. But for those families that can't afford it, and we do have some, they can come out and in exchange for working and helping us and pulling some weeds, if they can do that, or working on a weekend, whenever they might be available, they can get produce. And we do that with students. We have students from Sonoma State and New College that mm-hmm. come out, and they'll work for a period of time and in exchange for getting the vegetables.
Mm-hmm. So there are ways.
Uh-huh. It's not elitist in the sense, I mean, it's slightly elitist,
and I don't
because
mean
we're
so
in an
much,
elitist community.
Yeah,
you know?
And I don't mean it so much as Canvas Ranch as elitist at all.
But CSAs.
But in general, right. What I'm wondering is, who are the heirloom varieties going to? Mm-hmm. Who gets to eat? I mean, we're in the center of the most amazing abundance. Mm-hmm. I mean, Luther Burbank would be really proud, I think, in so many ways of what has happened with certain elements of agriculture mm-hmm. in Northern California at this point. But I'm also concerned. I mean, one of the realities that people like you and, say, Ridgely Evers and Colleen McGlynn of DeVero Olive Oil, anyone who works the land in Northern California has to deal with the reality of the cost of land
right.
and the cost of labor. And you can't produce, you know, a tomato grown at Canvas Ranch. You know, if you were to cost that out, it's mm-hmm. going to be way different mm-hmm. than even a tomato grown on a factory farm in Mexico.
Right.
So what I sort of want this these salon conversations to explore is that question. And how are we going to solve that? How are we going to deal with, I mean, because we will run out of oil.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the whole structure of agribusiness at some point will collapse and people will still have to eat.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really just sort of like my geeky moment on the radio, just really sort of exploring the philosophy and the changing philosophy of this. And I know one of the things that you do, and Terry, just jump in at any point, you're involved with schools and providing mm-hmm. produce for schools. Would you talk mm-hmm. a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's a nonprofit that I helped found last year. And it's called North Coast Grown, and we have a fabulous board of directors that involves people from all walks of the community. In fact, John Ash was one of the people that, and the Chefs Collaborative, they will come and do actual teaching classes for school cooks who see themselves as cooks. They don't see themselves as chefs, mm-hmm. but if we treat them as chefs and give them a few tools and things like that, then it helps them. But the beautiful thing about this is to try and get, and it's actually a lot of what we're doing is geared to schools that have greater than 26% free and reduced students, which means they're getting government subsidies mm-hmm. for their meals. And out of the three meals a day, two of them they're getting at school. They're getting breakfast and lunch.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea is to help the schools be able to afford local food that's coming from local farmers. It supports our local farm community. The kids are getting fresh fruits and vegetables. They're getting them at a reasonable price, and it's helping to support, you know, it all works together, helping to support the farmers. In addition, we're also doing nutrition education and things like bringing kids out to the farm. We did that last year at my place, and Dusky Estes from Zazu mm-hmm. came out, and she worked with the kids, had them go up into the field, and they picked the vegetables and brought them down to our patio. And she had set up an outdoor kitchen, and they made alphabet soup. And so there was a direct connection for the kids between what they had just picked, the carrots and whatever, and the food that they were eating. And you just saw light bulbs go off all over the place. Mm-hmm. So it's that kind of thing that we need to do. And in order to be able to do more of that, so it's not elitist food, mm-hmm. we just need more of it. Mm-hmm. We need more farmers in this area. That's one of the things that I'm really struggling with in North Coast Grown, is we just don't have enough farmers. And so I'm actually working with individuals. I'd like to expand this, but I don't have enough time, but mm-hmm. work with individuals on putting in, you know, some 10 by 20 raised beds in their backyard, and we'll go and pick the stuff up from them. So,
well, that's what a great thing to do.
Wouldn't that be great? And I'll, you know, I can teach them. I'm a new farmer, so I know what it takes to figure out how to grow something like that. And you could grow it for your kids' school, and mm-hmm. Have the kids come out and help you turn over the compost or whatever has to happen. But, those kinds of things, and also to establish community gardens and school gardens so that kids are growing things on their school campus. Mm-hmm. And then it's not elitist anymore.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and I think that getting at that level, mm-hmm. children, kindergarten on up, and if you talk, that's where it has to start, I think, for it to have a long life. Mm-hmm. And we, in a way, we have to correct some of the things that have gone wrong for the last couple of generations. And I was just going to ask you, Terry, and you too, Deborah, what were childhood lunches like when you were growing up?
My mother always made our lunches, and sandwich, fruit, usually some vegetable sticks.
Taken to school?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Once a week we'd get a surprise wrapped in foil, like a Hostess Twinkie or something, but that was the only time during the week. Mm-hmm. Because I said all the other kids have, like, quote-unquote, good stuff, and we had healthy stuff. We had wonderful lunches.
Uh-huh. I had, I grew up on lettuce and mayonnaise on Wonder Bread. I'm not kidding. That's mm-hmm. what I made for myself, I think, every single day from mm-hmm. second through fifth grade. And I grew up in a house where my mother put a brown thing, a white thing, and a green thing on the plate. Mm-hmm. And so, consequently, I never got connected to food until mm-hmm. I started growing it. Mm-hmm. And now, I mean, you can't take me to a restaurant. I'm really not nice about the vegetables I get in a lot of places.
Uh-huh. I remember when I was really little, I went home for lunch. Mm. I think you see a lot less of that now in the United States. You talk to people in Europe, and it's changing. And one of the things, say, people in southern Italy really bemoan is the loss of that 2-2.5 hour lunch. But people still in France, in Italy, in Spain, if they can, they go home for lunch and they eat together. And I remember going to my grandmother's house sometimes for lunch. I remember going home for lunch, and eventually, I don't know whose idea it was, but eventually, you know, I had, you know, the lunchbox or the school cafeteria. So that tradition of everyone eating together is probably a platonic ideal that may not be achievable.
I think it can be. I think people make it way too complicated, mm-hmm. and there are too many quickie alternatives that are just kind of enticing and suck you in. And I think that if people are really come back and say, you know, in 20 minutes you can make just about anything. So
yeah. Canvas Ranch is canvasranch.com.
Yes, it is.
You have room for subscribers?
We do. We're expanding this year. We're tripling our size.
Great. Thank you, Deborah, very much for taking the time to come on again so soon. Terry, again, in a Cajun Kitchen, Terry Pischoff at Werthner, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And good luck on your continuing book tour. It's Michelle Jordan. It's been Mouthful. Be sure to tune in next week for another yummy episode here on KRCB.
Local presentation of Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour, is made possible in part by the Press Democrat, your local newspaper for over 148 years and 2004 winner of the George Polk Award. The Press Democrat, bringing you news that's important to your life. And from Tandem Winery, celebrating diversity in locally produced radio shows on KRCB, tandemwinery.com or 823-2794. and JAG Public Relations, providing comprehensive marketing communications, focusing on small and medium-sized businesses in wine, hospitality, and entertainment industries. JAG Public Relations will manage your web content, write copy, and fill your graphic design and still photography needs. More information available at 707-795-9400 or at jagpublicrelations.com.
Get out of my kitchen. Get out of my kitchen. Get out of my kitchen and let me cook.